And hello, SunSouth listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now close to 3 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled A Daydreamy Child Takes a Walk. And then it's Geraldine and the Space Bees, The Teeny Weeny Unicorn, The Moose Fairy, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Best Friend in the Whole World. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled A Daydreamy Child Takes a Walk. Mama, I'm going out for a walk. Have fun, Giovanni, but look both ways before you cross the street. I will, Mama. Bye, Mama. And don't get distracted along the way. I won't, Mama. Bye, Mama. Giovanni goes cheerfully out the door, and for the first block or so, he pays close attention, stopping every so often to check that he hasn't lost anything. Am I all here? Yes, I am. And he laughs happily to himself. Giovanni is so pleased with how careful he's been that he starts hopping along like a sparrow. Soon enough, though, he's completely distracted, staring at shop windows, cars, the clouds, and naturally, trouble follows. A man very politely tells him, "Oh, little one, you need to pay attention. Look, you've already lost a hand." "Yes, sir, you're right. My head is always in the clouds." Giovanni starts searching for his hand, but finds an empty can instead. "Is it really empty? Let me take a look," thinks Giovanni. What was in it before it was empty? It can't have been empty right from the start. Giovanni forgets about looking for his hand, and then he forgets about the tin can, too, because he spotted a dog with a limp. In his hurry to catch up with the limping dog before it turns the corner, he loses a whole arm. But he doesn't notice and just keeps running. "Giovanni, Giovanni, your arm!" a nice woman calls after him. But of course, he pays her no mind. "Oh well," says the woman, "I'll just bring it along to his mother." And she sets off for Giovanni's mother's house. "Hello, I've brought you your son's arm." "Oh dear, his head is always in the clouds. I just don't know what to say or do anymore." "Well, it's no mystery. That's just the way children are." A little while later, another nice woman comes over to visit. "Hello, I found a foot." "It wouldn't belong to your boy Giovanni, would it?" "Why, of course it's his. I'd recognize that shoe with a hole in its sole anywhere." "Oh, what a distractible child. I just don't know what to say or do anymore." "Well, it's no mystery. That's just the way children are." Then a little old lady comes by, and the baker's delivery boy, and a trolley conductor, and even a retired school teacher, and each brings some piece or other of Giovanni. A leg, an ear, his nose. "Has there ever been a boy as daydreamy as my son, Giovanni?" "Oh, don't worry, that's just the way children are." At last, Giovanni himself comes home, hopping on one foot, with no ears or arms, but as cheerful as a sparrow, as he always is. And his mother shakes her head, puts him back together, and gives him a kiss. Is anything missing, Mama? Have I been a good boy today? Yes, Giovanni, you're a most wonderful boy. Geraldine and the Space Bees. Geraldine was watering her mom's flowers, but something was definitely wrong. This is very strange. Where are the rest of the bees? She asked the two lonely bumblebees hovering above her head. Usually there were swarms of bees. Geraldine had even worn her makeshift beekeeper outfit, made from Dad's old shirt and Mom's favorite lampshade. What could be going on? The next day at school, Mrs. Headley had a special announcement, but Geraldine was barely listening. She was still thinking about the missing bees. Where were those pesky little insects? She would have to ask her mom after school. Suddenly, she heard the words Space Museum fly out of Miss Headley's mouth. Space Museum? Now she was listening. That's right, Geraldine. I have planned a special field trip, repeated Mrs. Headley. We are going to the Space Museum. Geraldine was excited. She stood up, threw her arms in the air, and shouted, "Yes, yes, yes!" Ever since she won the science contest with her spectacular telescope eyeglasses, she had wanted to visit outer space, especially Mars. The day of the field trip, Geraldine packed her new 3D camera into her backpack. She had made it herself out of recycled plastic and old lenses. She also packed her award-winning eyeglasses, just in case. Everyone was fascinated as the tour guide, Mr. Carter, described what it is like to travel in outer space. "Floating in zero gravity feels amazing. One little push can send you gliding through the air," he explained to the group. Then he led them through the exhibits. They saw an enormous rocket, two rocket boosters, a space shuttle engine, and a video of a rocket launch. Geraldine was fascinated when Mr. Carter said that scientists send plants and animals into space to see how they adapt to space travel. At the end of the tour, Mr. Carter announced that he had homework for the class. "Each of you will create a model of something you would like to send into outer space, and explain why." "I would send an elephant," said Braden, "to see if it would float." "I would send a spider to see if it could spin a web," said Juliana. "How about a cactus?" shouted Geraldine. "Would it grow down instead of up?" Mr. Carter told the class that he would come to their classroom in 1 week to see their projects. That evening, Geraldine thought and thought. What would she most like to send into space? Then she remembered the bees. The bees! Her mom had told her about the bee population declining and that something called pesticides were to blame. "That's it!" yelled Geraldine. "I will build a device that will let bees travel into outer space. What if bees could survive in a spaceship without these chemicals?" Geraldine was now excited. If she couldn't go to Mars, maybe her bees could. She hunted through her pile of gadgets. She would build a clean, pesticide-free feeding station for the bees that would help scientists learn why the bees were disappearing. Rummaging through Dad's shed, Geraldine found an old wooden crate. She filled it with dirt from her mom's pesticide-free garden and painted the outside of the crate purple to attract the bees. She carefully dug up some of Mom's flowers and replanted them in the crate, then pressed several of Mom's teacups into the dirt. They were just the right size for holding water. Perfect, she thought. The bees will have plenty of room to float around when they become weightless. Geraldine covered the crate with an old lace curtain and tied it with a pink ribbon. She set the box in her mother's garden with the top slightly open so the bees could find their way in. The following week, as her classmates displayed their projects, Geraldine was nervous. She had only been able to capture 2 bees. When it was Geraldine's turn to present, she took a deep breath and explained, "Bees are dying because of the pesticides used on flowers. If bees can't pollinate the plants, our food supply will be affected. We have to do something. I would like to send bees into outer space so they can make more bees in a clean environment. We can raise a new generation of healthy bees and bring them back to Earth."
"Well, what a clever invention," said Mr. Carter. "Can I use it as an exhibit in the Space Museum?"
"Of course," said Geraldine. Mrs. Headley was proud. So was Mr. Carter. Geraldine was very proud. And here it says pollination. Why are bees so important? Pollination is a very fine powder. Pollen is a very fine powder that bees carry from one plant to another. This fertilizes the plants, helping them grow baby plants called seedlings. Without pollination, we would not have as many flowers or foods available. That is why it is so important for scientists to find ways to save the bees. Western honeybees are the most common of the 712 honeybee species worldwide. They are the most important pollinators globally and face threats of and extinction that could be absolutely disastrous for our planet. The Teeny-Weeny Unicorn. Once upon a time, in a land where horses were mythical beasts, found only in the pages of books for children, it was common to see a unicorn, but not one this size. The Teeny-Weeny Unicorn. The Teeny-Weeny Unicorn lived with his family in a large palace. For him, it was an extra-large palace. The steps were extra-large. The stoops were extra-large. The rugs were extra-large. The food was extra-large. And the toys and games, too. When the Teeny-Weeny Unicorn's brother and sister played chess, they used him in place of the missing piece. "Can I have a turn?" he asked. "You're too teeny-weeny," said Fancy Annie. "I'll move you when I'm ready." She moved her rook instead. "Captured your pawn," brayed Prince Butterscotch. He knocked the Teeny-Weeny Unicorn over with the butt of his knight. On nice days, their parents lounged on the ramparts while the kids swam in the moat. "Check out my splash," Fancy Annie whinnied and did a cannonball off the drawbridge. "Can I have a turn?" asked the Teeny-Weeny Unicorn. "You're too teeny-weeny," said Prince Butterscotch. "A gumball would make a bigger splash than you." Fancy Annie surfaced, spitting a mouthful of moat water. "You're so teeny-weeny, you'd get lost in the lawn." The Teeny-Weeny Unicorn stamped his teeny-weeny hoof. "I'm sick and tired of being teeny-weeny." And into the garden he ran, crying teeny-weeny tears. When he tired of galloping, he cantered, then trotted, then walked. "I am lost in the lawn," he admitted sadly. Just then, a gnome came huffing and puffing through the grass.
"I've been chasing you for ages."
"Oh," said the Teeny-Weeny Unicorn, "I'm sorry."
"Sorry doesn't feed the bullfrog," she said, trying to catch her breath.
The Teeny-Weeny Unicorn was confused. "What bullfrog?" The gnome plucked a dandelion seed
and picked her tooth with it.
"Well, I sure do pity giants like you, lumbering about, unaware of anybody but yourselves."
The teeny-weeny unicorn was extra confused. "What giants?" She shook her head.
"Follow me."
No more than 10 yards back, they came to a sporty roadster, brand new, apart from the giant hoof print. The gnome pointed.
"See what you've done?"
"Oh, you must be mistaken," said the teeny-weeny unicorn. "I am much too teeny-weeny to smash a car." The gnome squinted up at him.
"You're huge."
"I'm not huge," said the teeny-weeny unicorn. "You're just eeny, teeny, weeny."
"Wrong," said the gnome. "I'm just the right size. Now put your hoof here and let's see if it fits."
He was guilty, but also a little proud, but mostly guilty. "There must be some way I can repay you," cried the teeny-weeny unicorn.
$250,000?
The teeny-weeny unicorn whistled. "Isn't that a lot for such a small car?"
"Well, that's the knock on it," said the gnome. "But she handles like a dream."
"Well, I'll have to ask my parents," the teeny-weeny unicorn said doubtfully. The gnome climbed onto his snout and mounted his horn.
"Giddy up!"
They galloped, then cantered, then trotted, then walked to the castle door. The teeny-weeny unicorn's teeth clacked.
"Relax, kid," said the gnome. "I have a big brother about your size. He lives under a bridge. But if he asked, I'd give him the gold from my molars. Know what I'm saying?"
"Sort of," said the teeny-weeny unicorn.
"Family's family," said the gnome, and rang the bell.
She also did all of the talking. Unicorns, like most living species, have no use for money, but luckily their palace had formerly belonged to a terrible hoarder of the stuff. The unicorns were glad to be rid of some clutter. A carriage was piled high with gold, cash, and coins. No one even bothered counting it. The teeny-weeny unicorn turned to Fancy Annie and Prince Butterscotch. "I would pull the cart," he said, "but I'm too teeny-weeny." A footman appeared. "Your highnesses, your harnesses." Fancy Annie and Prince Butterscotch grumbled with their noses in the gravel, while many buckles and bits were pulled snug. "When we get back," said Fancy Annie, "you owe us big time." Prince Butterscotch shook his mane. "You're lucky you're our little brother."
"Family's family," said the gnome, taking the reins,
and off she drove them to wherever she lived. The teeny-weeny unicorn did feel lucky to have a big brother and sister, but that didn't mean he couldn't savor the days they were gone. Of course, he played chess. He did lots of cannonballs. He also had a great adventure with the ghost in the North Tower. But that's a bigger story, and this book is running short on pages. So I will tell you this instead. We are all teeny-weeny. We are all giant. And we are all just the right size. The Moose Fairy. Moose was walking through the forest one day when he saw a poster. "Secret Fairy Club. New members wanted. Meeting today, 11 o'clock, at the Old Oak Tree. Bring your own costume. Free fairy cakes. All welcome. P.S. Top Secret." Moose couldn't believe his luck. He had always wanted to be a fairy. "I must find something to wear," he thought, and he ran off to get ready.
Back at home, Moose looked through his dress-up box and tried on some outfits. Could this work? No. A clown fairy? No. This hat? No. Ah, my wand and crown. Ta-da! This is the one. Moose felt fabulous in his fairy costume, but when he arrived at the old oak tree, he couldn't help but notice that everybody else was, well, little. What are you doing here? Asked Mouse rudely. Well, I've come to join the secret fairy club, replied Moose in a loud whisper. Shh, said the others. It's a secret. But the poster said, all welcome, replied Moose, confused. Oh, you are welcome, Moose, said Miss Twinkle, the head fairy. Now, time for the test, everyone. There was a twirling test, a wand-waving test, and a making glitter pictures test. Moose loved them all. Then they had to say the fairy oath. Fairies are kind to all creatures. Fairies are not mean or bitter. Fairies help others in trouble or need and make pretty pictures with glitter. Well done, everyone, said Miss Twinkle. You've all passed. Moose was so excited. Next, Miss Twinkle taught them the secret knock to open the clubhouse door. Why don't you try it first, Moose? She said. Knock, knock, knockety knock, 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 knock. As if by magic, the secret door opened. But it was tiny. Everyone else ran, laughing, into the clubhouse, but poor Moose was left outside. The rude little mouse stuck her head out of the window. You can't be in our club, she said. You just don't fit in. Feeling miserable, Moose walked away. Taking a bath, Moose? Asked Fox, as he watched from the riverbank. No, sighed Moose. I'm trying to shrink so I can get into the secret fairy club and eat fairy cakes with all the little creatures. Fox thought of all those little creatures stuffed with fairy cakes. Now, sounds delicious, he grinned. I think I'd like to join, too. Well, it's in the old oak tree, said Moose miserably. The secret knock goes knock, knock, knockety knock, 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 knock. But don't tell anyone, it's a secret. But Fox had already gone. Back in the old oak tree, Mrs. Twinkle looked around. Where's Moose? She asked. The fairies looked at each other rather sheepishly. Oh, he's gone, wailed Beaver. We were so mean to poor Moose, just because he's different, cried Squirrel. He was wonderful at glitter pictures, said Mouse quietly. Just then, knock, knock, knockety knock, 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 knock. Moose, they cheered, you're just in time for dinner, growled Fox, squeezing through the door. Meanwhile, Moose, dripping with water, approached the old oak tree. Maybe I've shrunk by now, he thought. Suddenly, Moose heard a cry, help, help! He rushed to the tree, but couldn't get inside. You can't help, came Fox's voice from the tree, because you just don't fit in. Yes, I do, cried Moose, charging at the tree. Crash, smash! Fox was so scared that he ran out of the tree and disappeared into the forest. The fairies were shaken and scared, but not hurt. Oh, thank you, Moose, they said. You saved us, even though we were mean to you, cried Mouse. Of course, said Moose. I took the fairies' oath. Fairies are kind to all creatures. Fairies are not mean or bitter. Fairies help others in trouble or need.
and make pretty pictures with glitter. Everyone joined in.
"We were just about to make some glitter pictures. Will you join us?" asked Miss Twinkle.
"But you said I don't fit in," said Moose sadly.
"We were wrong," cried the fairies. "You are the best fairy of all."
"That's right," said Miss Twinkle. "In fact, you don't just fit in. You belong."
And for the first time in a very long time, Moose felt that he really did.
Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a story about a rabbit, and this is titled Best Friend in the Whole World. Roland lived deep in the woods all by himself. He had a quiet life of drawing and music and drinking tea. But sometimes he was lonely. Often, he would take walks in the woods, wandering among the trees, hoping, just maybe, to find a friend.
"Hello," asked Roland. "Are you also looking for a friend?"
Roland called his new friend Milton. They were perfect for each other, and Milton is a pine cone. Milton also loved drawing and music and drinking tea. Together, they were happy. One day, while on a walk in the woods, Roland and Milton spotted something new.
A sign that says missing. Popkin, brown, pointy, and quiet.
Oh, it's another pine cone.
"That kind of looks like you," said Roland.
"But your name is Milton."
"Missing, last seen at the log by the lake." And there's another pine cone.
"That can't be you," said Roland. "I found you on the path among the trees."
And then another sign, missing, loves puzzles, baking, and lemonade. And it's a picture of the pine cone.
"Well, that's definitely not you," said Roland, "because you love drawing, music, and tea.
That's why you're my best friend in the whole world."
"What's this?"
"Missing, best friend in the whole world." And it's another picture of a pine cone. And there are flyers all over the place.
Back at home, Roland could not forget about the signs. Soon, the lonely feelings from before all came tumbling back. And everything was worse than ever. Roland wondered if anyone else in the whole world was also feeling lonely. So Roland paid a visit to the log by the lake.
"Hello," said a voice as the door opened.
"Oh, you found Popkin. I have been so worried."
"Thank you," she said, "for bringing my best friend home."
Roland returned to his home all by himself. And he wrote a letter. "Dear Milton," is crossed out, "and Popkin, thank you for spending a few days with me. I had a lot of fun and will miss you. Your friend, Roland."
Without a best friend, life would be quiet again.
There he is looking at all the pictures. Or she is looking at all the pictures. That night, Roland felt more lonely than ever. So the next day, after some drawing, music, and tea, Roland went for a walk in the woods. As he wandered among the trees, Roland realized, and he sees another sign nailed to a tree that says, "Wanted new friends." And then he sees a sign that says, "Hello." He knew exactly where to find a friend. And he sees Popkin, and he sees Popkin's friend as well. And now all three of them are friends. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for close to 3 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week, CJ, who happens to be Russell's dad's lawyer, told Darcy and Russell that no charges would be held for swimming in the hotel pool without permission. So they thought, or they're thinking like everything was over until CJ started asking them more questions. And that's where we left off last week. Now, CJ said, she set aside her legal pad and opened up her laptop. Let's get down to business, shall we? Oh, I said, glancing over at Russell. Wasn't that what we'd just been doing? What do you mean, Russell asked. Aren't we done? Almost, CJ said breezily. Just a few more things to clarify, and then we can all go our separate ways. As charming as this has been. She looked from me to Russell, giving us a smile that didn't meet her eyes. So, you two had quite a whirlwind tonight, quite the sudden romance. I felt my face get hot. As embarrassing as it had been to go over everything that had happened with Russell in my head, I hadn't realized how much worse it would be to have to talk about it with a stranger in a business suit. And her paralegal on the phone, and possibly the paralegal's boyfriend. Well, Russell said, and his face was bright red now. He looked exactly how I felt, like he was willing the floor to open up and swallow him whole. I'm not sure how that's relevant. Well, your dad pays me to look at all the angles, kid, she said, giving him a smile that seemed genuinely sympathetic for just a moment. But then she turned to me, and all kindness was gone, even though it was quite cold in the Saturday Night Falls conference room. I could feel my palms start to sweat. All at once, I knew that this woman didn't like me, and that she was not on my side. Now, Darcy, she said, emphasizing my name in a way I didn't love, you said you met Russell tonight at the bus station. Yeah, I said, glancing across the table at him. That's what happened. You'd never met before? No, Russell said, sounding as baffled by this as I felt. We hadn't. You're both based in L.A., she said as she pulled something up on her laptop and scrolled down. No, we're not. Russell's in Ojai. My voice trailed off as I looked over at him. He was staring down at his hands, and I realized that he'd been lying about this, too. You don't live in Ojai? I said, not phrasing it as a question. Let me see, CJ continued, scrolling on her laptop. You live with your father. Your mother is in England. My head snapped up at this, and I looked at Russell, suddenly realizing that he must have told Sarah, the paralegal, this when he was on the phone with her. For a second, I thought about correcting this,
but then I let it go. Why should I be setting the record straight when Russell was lying to me left and right? You and Russell are both the same age, the same grade, and you do have a mutual friend in common, according to your social media accounts. Darcy, Willa Curtis, I lean forward to try to look at CJ's laptop screen, but the sides of the buses are really long, which meant this table was too. How do you know Willa? Russell asked me. Well, we volunteered together. An image of Willa, blue hair, quick laugh, septum piercing, flashed across my mind. It had been a beach cleanup project, and we'd been paired together. She was from Harvard Westlake, one of the private schools in L.A., which I realized a second later probably meant Russell went there too, knowing that he was actually a lot closer to where I lived. To people I knew was making me feel his deception all the more strongly. Oh, Russell said, Will is in my class. Or was, I guess. So not total strangers, CJ said with a nod. But wait, why are you looking at my social media? Well, your accounts are public, aren't they? Well, yes, I swallowed hard. It had never occurred to me that what I put online would be of any interest to someone who didn't already know me. It was also personal and specific. Pictures of Dee Dee and Katie, a series in which I reviewed my daily lunch sandwich in a fake French accent, giving them a number grade with wildly shifting parameters. Way too many shots, according to Dee Dee, of the jacaranda tree at the end of our street. Who else would care about these things? But I truly got now what I meant for my accounts to be public. It meant all the stuff I'd put out there, intending it only for my friends, could be assessed by anyone with an internet connection and an interest in finding out about me. And this lawyer apparently had both. Why are you looking into Darcy? Russell asked. I thought you were just here about the hotel. Well, my job is to protect the interest and mitigate the legal exposure of Wiley Sanders, CJ said, and by extension, Russell here. And now, she said, looking at me over her glasses, we need to figure out where you fit into the picture. I blinked at her. What? What is that supposed to mean? Well, you said you'd never met Russell before tonight, that you didn't know who he was. I didn't. He didn't tell me who he really was. In fact, he told me his dad was a structural engineer. He lived in Ojai, and his name was Russell Henron. As I spoke, I was getting mad all over again. And you believe this? CJ asked. She gave me a smile that clearly said, nice try, kid. Because I understand you're a Nighthawks fan, right? According to a number of public comments you've made. As has your father, I believe. It seems like he's also a fan. Edward Milligan? Ted, I corrected automatically, then felt my stomach plunge. It was like my dad had suddenly walked in here, which was honestly the last thing I wanted. It was one thing for CJ to know basic facts about me. It was another for her to be digging up things about my father, because I hadn't ever told Russell my dad's name. I was pretty sure about that. Well, I don't understand why you're doing this, Russell said, staring at CJ. What's going on? CJ took off her glasses and folded them, then turned to Russell. When she spoke, her voice was softer, like she was breaking bad news. While we've done a good job of keeping you kids out of the public eye, you still can find information and pictures if you're so motivated. And Darcy here is an admitted Nighthawks fan. She turned and looked at me, her expression stony, which leads me to believe that she was not as in the dark as she claims. What? I still felt like I was a beat behind. You think I know who Russell was and pretended not to? CJ nodded, looking relieved I'd finally caught up. Why would I? CJ let out a short laugh and gestured around her, like she was pointing out everything surrounding her. The conference room, the gold records on the walls, and the penny dropped. You think? I managed to get out my voice, a hoarse whisper, that I was trying to trick him? I could feel my face burn, and I didn't know how this had happened. I was the one who had been wronged here. He was the one who had tricked me. Darcy didn't know who I was, Russell said, his voice low and serious. And for you to imply... Then let's not imply it, CJ said. We can just say it straightforward. I'm finding it awfully coincidental that a huge Nighthawks fan runs into the son of her favorite rock star and then just happens to lure him into a compromising situation in which she has leverage for a potential financial windfall. I closed my eyes for just a moment, like I could make this go away. My mind snagged on the word lure. It wouldn't stop reverberating in my head. Like nothing else that had happened with Russell and me tonight actually mattered. This lawyer and her paralegal on the phone thought I was someone who had lured him to a hotel pool, not because I'd liked him, but for some kind of payday. I felt suddenly like I needed to take a shower. The most personal thing that had ever happened to me was being dragged out into the light to be discussed by strangers. It made everything feel tainted, like if my memories of tonight were on a piece of paper, it had just been crumpled up, and I'd never be able to get the creases out again. I didn't do that. My voice was shaking wildly with some combination of anger and shame that was making it very hard to keep things together. And I knew I was about 3 seconds away from bursting into tears, which was the last thing I wanted. Nobody cares about me, Russell said, and I saw his face was bright red. They care about my dad, and nobody has any interest in what his kids do. On the phone, Sarah let out a quick laugh. Sorry, she said immediately. That was unprofessional. Carry on. Kid, CJ said with a sigh, we're living in a clickbait world. You know that. The pictures from Mallorca with Montana? You saw what happened there? My older sister, Russell muttered to me. I realized two things in quick succession. The first was that, of course, Russell wasn't the only child he'd pretended to be when he wanted to have something in common with me. And the second was remembering the scandal and how, when it had broken and made headlines, I'd read the story like it was entertainment. She was photographed jumping off a yacht that didn't belong to her. CJ explained. Naked, Sarah supplied from the phone. Sorry, I just thought it might be relevant. One of Montana's so-called friends took pictures and sold them to Deitz Moy, CJ said, shaking her head. And it didn't matter if anyone hadn't heard about Montana Sanders before then. All you needed to hear was that Wiley Sanders' daughter was behaving badly off the coast of Spain to get people to click on the article, not to mention what happened with your friend, young man, earlier this year.
I looked over at Russell, who was staring down at the table, his shoulders tight. "So I hear about this," she continued, gesturing to me, "and naturally..." "No," I interrupted. I could feel the first hot tear threatening to tip over, like it was balanced on a precipice, and I tried to will it back. "I didn't do anything like that. I wouldn't." I crossed my arms in front of me, trying to hold myself together. "I just..." "Stop," Russell said. He sounded angrier and more serious than I had yet heard him. "Enough of this. I lied to Darcy about who I was. I was the one who deceived her, not the other way around." I saw CJ take a breath like she was going to refute this, but Russell kept going. "We met at a bus station," he said. "She didn't know who I was. I didn't tell her who I was. We were both stranded there, and we started talking. We ended up walking around and getting to know each other." He took a shaky breath. "We had a really wonderful night. It was great." "Oh, that's so romantic," Sarah sighed from the phone. "It really is," her boyfriend agreed. "Sarah," CJ said sharply. "Right, sorry." "So, we're done talking about this," Russell said, a note of finality in his voice. "Nothing that you're implying happened, okay?" CJ looked at him for a long time, then nodded. "All right," she finally said. She glanced over at me, and I tried to glare back, but I felt my lip wobble and looked down at the metal, covered by a layer of lacquer reflecting off the lights in the conference room. "So can I go?" A second after I said it, I wondered if I even needed to ask permission. Maybe I could just get up, walk out, and start putting some distance between myself and this whole horrible situation. Could she actually stop me? "One last thing," she flipped through her papers, then slid something across the table to me, followed by a second later by a pen. "I'm just going to need you to sign that." "What is it?" Russell asked as I picked up the paper. Non-disclosure agreement was printed at the top. My name and address had already been filled in, and there was a little yellow sticky flag at the bottom of the page pointing to where I should sign. "Standard NDA," CJ said, her eyes on me. "If Darcy really has no ulterior motive here, she won't mind signing it." "She doesn't need to do that," Russell protested. "I mean, you're right," CJ said with a small shrug. "It's totally her choice, absolutely. But if she decides not to sign, all the strings we pulled to get you two out of trouble at the Silver Standard would no longer apply to her." I looked up at CJ sharply. "What?" "We're happy to help you as long as we're all on the same team. But if we're not..." She spread her hands like there was nothing she could do. "Fine," I muttered as I picked up the pen and uncapped it with shaky hands. Not telling anyone about this seemed like a great idea, frankly. "You don't have to do that, Darcy," Russell said, looking from CJ to the phone, like somehow Sarah could help him from her apartment in New York. "If Darcy says she's not going to talk about it..." "Oh, that's sweet," CJ said, "but we don't take people's words for it in my line of work. And I mean, let's be logical. You two have known each other for, what, 4 hours, five?" I looked across the table at Russell, then away again, even though it was basically what I'd thought to myself on the helicopter. It somehow sounded worse coming from CJ, like I'd been stupid to think anything different. 4 hours isn't enough to know a basset hound," she said, "let alone a person. So I think it's better for everyone to just get it into a legally binding document." I shook my head and scrawled my signature on the bottom of the paper. I pushed the paper and pen back across the table to her and stood up. "I can go," I said, not exactly phrasing it as a question.
CJ nodded. We'll be in touch if anything comes up. I was about to ask how when I realized that she probably had all the information on me that she needed. After all, she'd known my address and my dad's name and who I'd done ninth grade community service with. My cell phone number was probably already in one of her files somewhere. I unplugged my phone, then shoved the charger across the table at Russell. Darcy, he started, but I just shook my head. I grabbed my bag and walked down the conference room hallway, the way we'd come in. I no longer wanted to stop and look at every single thing in the trophy case and on the walls. I felt like I'd just been behind the curtain. The machinations of how someone got to stay this successful this long. They hired lawyers who were available late on Sunday nights to make problems go away. And who cares how it made people feel? This empire, everything hanging on the walls, was what needed to be protected. Not something as insignificant as someone's feelings. I reached the lobby area and saw the elevator where we'd come in. I looked around, then spotted a door a little farther down. I hurried toward it, pushed through into the cool night air, and took a deep, shaky breath. My feeling of relief to be out of there only lasted a second, though, as I looked around and realized I didn't know what to do next. I was on a flagstone path with gravel in between the paving stones. There were small, subtle lighting lining the walkway. Toward the right, I could see the main house, the one I'd spotted from the top of the helipad. I glanced to the left and took a few steps in that direction. There was what looked like a small parking lot and a long driveway that presumably led out to a road that would finally get me out of here. Could I just go? I didn't have my stuff, but my phone was at least a little charged now. Maybe I could just leave my duffel behind. I wasn't sure if there was anything in it that I desperately needed or that I couldn't be replaced. If it meant I didn't have to stay here any longer, I was willing to give it all up. But I'd only gone a few steps before I remembered the tent, the one I'd borrowed from Dee Dee and Katie. It was somewhere in the house, and I couldn't go back to Raven Rock without it. I turned and began to walk in the direction of the main house. I wasn't thrilled about knocking on Wiley Sanders' door and demanding my stuff back. But I was also just done. I'd been insulted and humiliated and pressured into signing a legally binding document. If there was one more embarrassing thing to get through tonight, so be it. Anything to get me out of here. So I never had to see or think about any of these people ever again. Darcy, I turned around and saw Russell standing behind me. I'm so sorry about that. He shook his head. I didn't know. I thought it was just going to be about the hotel. I never thought that she would. Well, she did. I hated that my voice was shaking again, that I felt like I was going to cry. But I don't think that, Russell said quickly, and I'm sure my dad doesn't either. He just pays her to do stuff like that. Oh, well, in that case, it's fine. That makes it all better. I walked a few steps away, fighting back the tears that were threatening to spill over, then turned back to him. So, you live in Ojai, huh? Only child? Structural engineering? He stared down at his feet. Well, we used to live in Ojai, and my dad always wanted to be a structural engineer. He still talks about it sometimes, says he's still building bridges. Just the musical kind. I shook my head, not about to be charmed by any of this. You could have told me the truth, you know, even if you didn't want to tell me about your dad. You didn't have to make up the rest of it. What was even the point of that? Just to mess with me? I'm so sorry, Darcy. Yeah, I interrupted, cutting him off. So you've said. But since I can't believe anything else you've told me, forgive me if I can't believe that either. Russell stepped back, a hurt look on his face. Look, I've apologized over and over again. I defend you in there. I don't know what else you want. I don't want anything from you, I snapped. I just want to go. I'm pretty sure you've done enough. Okay, Russell said, his voice rising. Sure, I mean, all I did was get us out of a situation where we could be in jail right now. I just got us out of Jesse and back to Vegas. So you're welcome for all that. You didn't do anything, I yelled. You just called your dad, and he did all of this. Don't pretend. Would you prefer I hadn't? Our voices were coming out raw and angry, overlapping, like we were throwing daggers at each other, pretending we didn't hurt where they connected. Did you want to be in jail somewhere in Nevada right now? Just so you can prove some kind of point? I glared at him. The logic was making me even angrier. No! And I wasn't going to bring it up, but... He stopped himself a second later and looked down at the paving stones. But what? The pool was your idea, he said, all in a rush. You were the one who suggested breaking into it. You were the one who wanted to swim. So this is my fault? Oh, did I not make that clear? Of course it is. Who else's fault would it be, Darcy? I swallowed hard, feeling my cheeks flame. Okay, fine. But you could have said no. You do have some choice in this matter. You didn't have to go along with it, you know. Well, I did, because I liked you. It was like we both heard the past tense at the same time, and I knew that it shouldn't have bothered me. I was leaving. I never wanted to see this guy again, but that didn't change the fact that it did. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because you are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long, and take care, everyone. Goodbye.